poses no threat. Only then might she be given a free enough rein to sniff out Sixsmith's fellow dissidents. Joe Napier, head of security, reminds Louisa of her father. Quiet, sober, similar age and hair loss. Once or twice during the sumptuous 10-course meal, she caught him watching her thoughtfully. And, Faye, you never feel confined on Swanicky Island at all? Swanicky, it's paradise, enthuses the publicist. Buenas yerbas only an hour away. L.A. down the coast, my family up in San Francisco, it's ideal. Subsidized stores and utilities, free clinic, clean air, zero crime, sea views. Even the men, she confides, sotto voce, come ready vetted. In fact, I can access their personal files, so you know there won't be any total freaks in the dating pool. Speaking of which, Isaac! Isaac, you're being conscripted! Fei Li grabs Isaac Sack's elbow. You'll remember bumping into Louisa Ray the other day. I'm one lucky conscript. Hi, Louisa, again. Louisa feels an edginess in his handshake. Miss Ray is here, says Fei Li, to write an article on Swanicky anthropology. Oh, we're a dull tribe. I hope you'll meet your word count. Fei Li turns her beam on full. I'm sure Isaac could find a little time to answer any of your questions, Louisa. Right, Isaac? I'm the very dullest of the dull. Don't believe him, Louisa, Fei Li warns her. It's just part of Isaac's strategy. Once your defenses are down, he pounces. The alleged lady killer rocks on his heels, smiling at his toes uncomfortably. 31. Isaac Sack's tragic flaw, analyzes Isaac Sacks, slumped in the bay window across from Louisa Ray 2 hours later, is this. Too cowardly to be a warrior, but not enough of a coward to lie down and roll over like a good doggy. His words slip like Bambi on ice. A mostly empty wine bottle stands on the table. The bar is deserted. Sacks can't remember when he was last this drunk, or this tense and relaxed at the same time. Relaxed because an intelligent young woman is enjoying his company. Tense because he is ready to lance the boil on his conscience. To Sacks's wry surprise, he is attracted to Louisa Ray, and he sorely regrets they met in these circumstances. The woman and the reporter keep blurring into one another. Let's change the subject, Sacks says. Your car, your... He does a Hollywood SS officer accent.
Volkswagen.
What's its name? How do you know my Beetle has a name? All Beetle owners give their cars names, but please don't tell me it's John, George, Paul, or Ringo.
God, Louisa Ray, you're beautiful.
She says, you'll laugh. I won't. You will. I, Isaac Casper Sacks, solemnly vow not to laugh. You'd better not with a middle name like Casper. It's Garcia. They both shake, noiselessly, until they burst into laughter. Maybe she likes me too. Maybe she's not just doing her job. Louisa lassos her laughter in. Is that all your vows are worth? Sacks makes a mea culpa gesture and dabs his eyes. They normally last longer. I don't know why it's so funny. I mean, Garcia, he snorts, isn't such a funny name. I once dated a girl who called her car Rosinante, for Christ's sakes. An ex-berserkly beatnik boyfriend named it, after Jerry Garcia, you know, the Grateful Dead man. He abandoned it at my dorm when its engine sent a gasket through the back around the time he dumped me for a cheerleader. Cheesy, but true. And you didn't take a blowtorch to it? It's not Garcia's fault his ex-owner was a swindling sperm gun. The guy must have been mad. Sacks didn't plan to say so, but he's not ashamed he did. Louisa Ray nods in gracious acknowledgement. Anyway, Garcia suits the car. Never stays tuned, prone to flashes of speed, falling to bits. Its trunk won't lock, it leaks oil, but never seems to give up the ghost. Invite her back, Sax thinks. Don't be stupid. You're not a pair of kids. They watch the breakers crash in the moonlight. Say it. The other day, his voice is a murmur and he feels sick. You were looking for something in Six Smith's room. The shadows seem to prick up their ears. Weren't you? Louisa checks for eavesdroppers and speaks very quietly. I understand Dr. Six Smith wrote a certain report. Rufus had to work closely with the team who designed and built the thing. That meant me. Then you know what his conclusions were about the Hydra reactor. We all do. Jessops, Moses, Keene, they all know. About a design flaw. Yes. Nothing has changed, except everything. How bad would an accident be? If Dr. Six Smith is right, it'll be much, much worse than bad. Why isn't Swanicky B just shut down pending further inquiry? Money, power, usual suspects. Do you agree with Six Smith's findings? Carefully. I agree a substantial theoretical risk is present. Were you pressured to keep your doubts to yourselves? Every scientist was. Every scientist agreed to. Except for Six Smith. Who, Isaac? Alberto Grimaldi? Does it go up to the top? Louisa, what would you do with a copy of the report if one found its way into your hands? Go public, as fast as I possibly could. Are you aware of... I can't say it. Aware that people in the upper echelons would rather see me dead than see Hydra discredited? Right now, it's all I'm aware of. I can't make any promises. Christ, how feeble. I became a scientist because... It's like panning for gold in a muddy torrent. Truth is the gold. I don't know what I want to do. Journalists work in torrents just as muddy. The moon is over the water. Do... says Louisa finally. Whatever you can't not do. 32. In blustery early sunshine, Louisa Ray watches golfers traverse the lush course, wondering what might have happened last night if she'd invited Isaac Sachs up. He's due to meet her for breakfast. She wonders if she should have phoned Javier. You're not his mother. You're not his guardian, you're just a neighbor. She's not convinced. But just as she didn't know how to ignore the boy she found sobbing by the garbage chute, just as she couldn't not go down to the supers, borrow his keys, and pick through a garbage can for his precious stamp albums, now she doesn't know how to extricate herself. He hasn't got anyone else. And 11-year-olds don't do subtlety. Anyway... who else have you got? You look like you got the weight of the world, says Joe Napier. Joe, have a seat. Don't mind if I do. I'm the bearer of bad news. Isaac Sachs sends his sincere apologies, but he's got to stand you up. Oh. Alberto Grimaldi flew out to our 3 Mile Island site this morning, wooing a group of Germans. Sidney Jessops was going along as the technical support, but Sid's father had a heart attack, and Isaac was the next choice. Oh. Has he left already? Afraid so. He's... Napier checks his watch. Over the Colorado Rockies. Breastfeeding a hangover, shouldn't wonder. Don't let your disappointment show. When's he due back? Tomorrow morning. Oh. Damn, damn, damn. I'm twice Isaac's age and 3 times uglier. but Faye's asked me to show you around the site. She's scheduled a few interviews with some people she thinks will interest you. Joe, it's too kind of you all to give me such generous slices of your weekends, says Louisa. Did you know Sax was on the verge of defection? How? Unless Sax was a plant. I'm out of my depth here. I'm a lonely old man with too much time on my hands. 33. So, R&D is called the chicken coop because the eggheads live there. Louisa jots in her notebook, smiling, as Joe Napier holds open the control room door 2 hours later. What do you call the reactor building? A gum-chewing technician calls out,
Home of the Brave.
Joe's expression says, funny.
That's definitely off the record.
Has Joe told you what we call the security wing?
The controller grins. Louisa shakes her head.
Planet of the Apes.
He turns to Napier.
Introduce your guest, Joe.
Carlo Bon, Louisa Ray. Louisa's a reporter. Carlo's a chief technician. Stick around and you'll hear plenty of other names for him.
Let me show you around my little empire if Joe'll give you up for 5 minutes.
Napier watches Louisa as Bon explains the fluorescent-lit chamber of panels and gauges. Underlings check printouts, frown at dials, tick clipboards. Bon flirts with her, catches Napier's eye when Louisa's back is turned, and mimes melon breasts. Napier shakes his sober head.
Millie would have clucked over you, he thinks. Had you over for dinner, fed you way too much, and nagged you on what you need to be nagged about.
He recalls Louisa as a precocious little 6-year-old.
Must be 2 decades since I saw you at the last 10th Precinct Station reunion. Of all the professions that lippy little girl could have entered, of all the reporters who could have caught the scent of Six Smith's death, why Lester Ray's daughter? Why so soon before I retire? Who dreamed up this sick joke? The city?
Napier could cry. 34. Fei Li searches Louisa Ray's room swiftly and adeptly as the sun sets. She checks inside the toilet cistern, under the mattress for slits, the carpets for loose flaps, inside the minibar, in the closet. The original might have been Xeroxed down to a quarter of its bulk. Lee's tame receptionist reported Sax and Louisa talking until the early hours. Sax was removed this morning, but he's no idiot. He could have deposited it for her. She unscrews the telephone mouthpiece and finds Napier's favored transmitter, one disguised as a resistor. She probes the recesses of Louisa's overnight bag, but finds no printed matter except Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. She flicks through the reporter's notepad on the desk. But Louisa's encrypted shorthand doesn't reveal much. Faye wonders if she's wasting her time.
Wasting your time?
Mexxon Oil upped their offer to $100,000 for the Six Smith report. And if they're serious about $100,000, they'll be serious about $1 million. For discrediting the entire atomic energy program into an adolescent grave, $1 million is a snip. So keep searching. The phone buzzes 4 times, a warning that Louisa Ray is in the lobby, waiting for the elevator. Lee ensures nothing is amiss and leaves, taking the stairs down. After 10 minutes, she rings up to Louisa from the front desk.
Hi, Louisa. It's Faye. Been back long?
Just long enough for a quick shower.
Productive afternoon, I hope?
Very much so. I've got enough material for 2 or 3 pieces.
Terrific. Listen, unless you've got other plans, how about dinner at the golf club? Swanakie lobster is the best this side of anywhere.
Quite a claim.
I'm not asking you to take my word for it.
35. Crustacean shrapnel is piled high. Louisa and Fei Li dab their fingers in pots of lemon-scented water, and Li's eyebrow tells the waiter to remove the plates.
What a mess I've made.
Louisa drops her napkin. I'm the slob of the class, Fei. You should open a finishing school for young ladies in Switzerland.
That's not how most people in Seaboard Village see me. Did anyone tell you my nickname?
No?
Mr. Li.
Louisa isn't sure what response is expected. A little context might help.
My first week on the job, I'm up in the canteen fixing myself a coffee. This engineer comes up, tells me he's got a problem of a mechanical nature, and asks if I can help. His buddies are sniggering in the background. I say, I doubt it. The guy says, sure you can help. He wants me to oil his bolt and relieve the excess pressure on his nuts.
This engineer was how old?
13?
40.
Married. 2 kids. So his buddies are snorting with laughter now. What would you do? Dash off some witty put-down line? Let him know you're riled? Slap him? Get labeled hysterical? Besides, creeps like that enjoy being slapped. Do nothing? So any man on site can say shit like that to you with impunity?
An official complaint?
Prove that women run to senior men when the going gets tough?
So what did you do?
Had him transferred to our Kansas plant. Middle of nowhere, middle of January. I pity his wife, but she married him. Word gets around, I get dubbed Mr. Li. A real woman wouldn't have treated the poor guy so cruelly. No, a real woman would have taken his joke as a compliment.
Fei Li smooths wrinkles in the tablecloth.
You run up against this crap in your work?
Louisa thinks of Nussbaum and Jakes. All the time.
Maybe our daughters will live in a liberated world, but us, forget it. We've got to help ourselves, Louisa. Men won't do it for us.
The journalist senses a shifting of the agenda. Fei Li leans in.
I hope you'll consider me your own insider here on Swanaki Island.
Louisa probes with caution. Journalists need insiders, Fei, so I'll certainly bear it in mind. I have to warn you, though, Spyglass doesn't have the resources for the kind of remuneration you may be.
Men invented money. Women invented mutual aid.
It's a wise soul, thinks Louisa, who can distinguish traps from opportunities.
I'm not sure how a small-time reporter could aid a woman of your standing, Fei.
Don't underestimate yourself. Friendly journalists make valuable allies.
If there comes a time when you want to discuss any matters weightier than how many French fries the Swanaki engineers consume per annum,
her voice sinks below the clinking of cutlery, cocktail bar piano music, and background laughter,
such as data on the Hydra reactor as compiled by Dr. Six Smith, purely for example, I guarantee you'll find me much more cooperative than you think.
Fei Li clicks her fingers, and the dessert trolley is already on its way.
Now, the lemon and melon sherbet? Very low in calories. It cleanses the palate. Ideal before coffee. Trust me on this?
The transformation is so total. Louisa almost wonders if she just heard what she just heard. I'll trust you on this.
Glad we understand each other.
Louisa wonders, what level of deceit is permissible in journalism? She remembers her father's answer one afternoon in the hospital garden. Did I ever lie to get my story? 10-mile-high whoppers every day before breakfast if it got me 1 inch closer to the truth. 36. A ringing phone flips Louisa's dreams over and she lands in the moonlit room. She grabs the lamp, the clock radio, and finally the receiver. For a moment, she cannot remember her name or what bed she is in.
Louisa, offers a voice from the black gulf.
Yeah? Louisa Ray? Louisa, it's me, Isaac. Isaac Sachs, calling long distance.
Isaac? Where are you?
What time is it? Why?
Shh.
Sorry I woke you. And sorry I was dragged away at the crack of dawn yesterday. Listen. I'm in Philadelphia. It's 7:30 Eastern. It'll be getting light soon in California. You still there, Louisa? I haven't lost you?
He's afraid.
Yeah, Isaac. I'm listening. Before I left Swanakie, I gave Garcia a present to give to you. Just a dolce far niente. He tries to make the sentence sound casual. Understand?
What in God's name is he talking about?
You hear me, Louisa? Garcia has a present for you. A more alert quarter of Louisa's brain muscles in. Isaac Sachs left the Sixsmith report in your VW. You mentioned the trunk didn't lock. He assumes we are being eavesdropped.
That's very kind of you, Isaac. Hope it didn't cost you too much.
Worth every cent. Sorry to disturb your beauty sleep. Have a safe flight, and see you soon.
Dinner, maybe?
I'd love that. Well, got a plane to catch.
Safe flight.
Louisa hangs up. Leave later, in an orderly fashion? Or get off Swanakie, right now. 37. A quarter of a mile across the science village, Joe Napier's window frames the hour before dawn night sky. A console of electronic monitoring equipment occupies half the room. From a loudspeaker, the sound of a dead phone line purrs. Napier rewinds a squawking reel-to-reel. Before I left Swanakie, I gave Garcia a present to give to you. Just a dolce far niente. Understand?
Garcia. Garcia.
Napier grimaces at his cold coffee and opens a folder labeled LR number 2. Colleagues, friends, contacts. No Garcia in the index. Better warn Bill Smoke not to approach Louisa until I've had the chance to speak with her. He flicks his lighter into life. Bill Smoke is a difficult man to find, let alone warn. Napier draws acrid smoke down into his lungs. His telephone rings. It's Bill Smoke. So who the fuck's this Garcia?
Don't know. Nothing on file.
Listen, I don't want you to...
It's your fucking job to know, Napier.
So you're addressing me like that now.
Hey! Hold your...
Hey yourself. Bill Smoke hangs up. Bad, bad, very bad. Joe grabs his jacket, snuffs his cigarette, leaves his quarters, and strides across the site to Louisa's hotel. A 5-minute walk. He recalls the menace in Bill Smoke's tone and breaks into a run. 38. A swarm of déjà vu haunts Louisa as she stuffs her belongings into her overnight bag. Robert Frobisher doing a dine-in dash from another hotel. She takes the stairs down to the empty lobby. The carpet is silent as snow. A radio whispers sweet nothings in the back office. Louisa creeps to the main doors, hoping to leave with no explanation required. The doors are locked to keep people out, not in, and soon Louisa is striding across the hotel lawn to the parking lot. A pre-dawn ocean breeze makes vague promises. The night sky inland is turning dark rose. Nobody else is about. But as she nears her car, Louisa forces herself not to break into a run. Stay calm, unhurried, and you can say you're driving along the Cape for the sunrise. At first glance, the trunk is empty. But the carpet covers a bulge. Under the flap, Louisa finds a package wrapped in a black plastic trash bag. She removes a vanilla binder. She reads its cover in the semi-light. The Hydra Zero Reactor, an operational assessment model. Project Head, Dr. Rufus Sixsmith.
Unauthorized possession is a federal crime under the Military and Industrial Espionage Act, 1971. Some 500 pages of tables, flowcharts, mathematics, and evidence. A sense of elation booms and echoes. Steady. This is only the end of the beginning. Motion in the middle distance catches Louisa's eye. A man. Louisa ducks behind Garcia. Hey, Louisa, hold it! Joe Napier. As if in a dream of keys and locks and doors, Louisa stows the vanilla binder in its black trash bag under the passenger seat. Napier is running now, his flashlight beam swishing the half-darkness. The engine makes a lazy, leonine roar. The VW reverses too fast. Joe Napier thumps into the back, yells, and Louisa glimpses him hopping like a slapstick actor. She does not stop to apologize. 39. Bill Smoke's dusty black Chevy skids to a stop by the island checkpoint of Swanakie Bridge. A string of lights dots the mainland across the straits. The guard recognizes the car and is already by its driver's window.
Good morning, sir.
Looking that way. Richter, isn't it?
Yes, Mr. Smoke.
I'm guessing Joe Napier has just called you and ordered you not to let an orange VW pass the checkpoint.
That's correct, Mr. Smoke.
I'm here to countermand that order. On Mr. Grimaldi's personal authority. You will raise the barrier for the VW and let me follow. You'll phone your buddy on the mainland checkpoint now and tell him not to let anything through until he sees my car. When Mr. Napier gets here, about 15 minutes from now, you will tell him Alberto Grimaldi says, go back to bed. Understand, Richter?
Understood, Mr. Smoke.
You got married this spring, if memory serves.
You have an excellent memory, sir.
I do.
Hoping to start a family?
My wife's 4 months pregnant, Mr. Smoke. A piece of advice, Richter, on how to succeed in the security business. Would you like to hear this piece of advice, son?
I would, sir.
The dumbest dog can sit and watch. What takes brains is knowing when to look away. Am I making sense to you, Richter?
You're making absolute sense, Mr. Smoke.
Then your young family's future is secure. Smoke reverses his car alongside the guardhouse and slumps low. 60 seconds later, a choking VW swerves around the headland. Louisa halts, rolls down her window. Richter appears, and Smoke catches the words, family emergency. Richter tells her to have a safe trip, and the barrier rises. Bill Smoke puts his car into first, second. The sonic texture of the road surface changes as the Chevy reaches the bridge. Third gear, fourth, pedal down. The clapped-out Beetle's taillights zoom up, 50 yards, 30 yards, 10. Smoke hasn't switched his lights on. He swerves into the empty oncoming lane, shifts into fifth gear, and draws alongside. Smoke smiles. She thinks I'm Joe Napier. He yanks the wheel sharply, and metal screams as the Beetle is sandwiched between his car and the bridge railing until the railing unzips from its concrete, and the Beetle lurches out into space. Smoke slams the brakes. He gets out into the cool air and smells hot rubber. Back a ways, 60, 70 feet down, a VW's front bumper vanishes into the hollow sea. If her back didn't snap, she'll have drowned in 3 minutes. Bill Smoke inspects the damage to his car's bodywork and feels deflation. Anonymous, faceless homicides, he decides, lack the thrill of human contact. The American Sun, cranked up to full volume, proclaims a new dawn.
The Ghastly Ordeal of Timothy Cavendish. One bright dusk, six summers ago, I strolled along a Greenwich Avenue of mature chestnuts and mock oranges in a state of grace. Those Regency residences number among London's costliest properties, but should you ever inherit one, dear reader, sell it. Don't live in it. Houses like these secrete some dark sorcery that transforms their owners into fruitcakes. One such victim, an ex-chief of Rhodesian police, had, on the evening in question, written me a check as rotund as himself to edit and print his autobiography. My state of grace was thanks in part to this check, and in part to a 1983 Chablis from the Dourozois vineyard, a magic potion that dissolves our myriad tragedies into mere misunderstandings. A trio of teenettes, dressed like prostitute Barbie, approached, drift-netting the width of the pavement. I stepped into the road to avoid collision, but as we drew level, they tore wrappers off their lurid ice lollies and just dropped them. My sense of well-being was utterly V2'd. I mean, we were level with a bin. Tim Cavendish, the disgusted citizen, exclaimed to the offenders, "You know, you should pick those up." A snorted, "What you gonna do about it?" glanced off my back. Ruddy she-apes. "I have no intention of doing anything about it," I remarked over my shoulder. "I merely said that you..." My knees buckled and the pavement cracked my cheek, shaking loose an early memory of a tricycle accident before pain erased everything but pain. A sharp knee squashed my face into leaf mold. I tasted blood. My 60-something wrist was winched back through 90 degrees of agony, and my Ingersoll Solar was unclasped. I recall a pick-and-mix of obscenities ancient and modern, but before my muggers could filch my wallet, the chimes of an ice-cream van playing The Girl from Ipanema scattered my assailants, like vampiresses the minute before dawn. "And you didn't report them, you dolt!" Madam X sprinkled synthetic sugar over her breakfast bran the next morning. "Phone the police, for Christ's sake. What are you waiting for? The train'll go cold." Alas, I had already amplified the truth and told her my muggers were 5 louts with swastikas shaved onto their skulls. How could I now file a report saying 3 prepubescent lollipop girls had bested me so effortlessly? The boys in blue would have choked on their penguin biscuits. No, my assault was not added to our nation's wishfully fulfilled crime statistics. Had my purloined Ingersoll not been a love present from a sunnier era of our now arctic marriage, I would have kept mum about the entire incident. Where was I? Odd how the wrong stories pop into one's head at my age. It's not odd, no. It's ruddy scary. I meant to begin this narrative with Dermot Hoggins. That's the problem with inking one's memoirs in longhand. You can't go changing what you've already set down, not without botching things up even more. Look, I was Dermot Duster Hoggins's editor, not his shrink or his ruddy astrologer, so how could I have known what lay in store for Sir Felix Finch on that infamous night? Sir Felix Finch, Minister of Culture and El Supremo at the Trafalgar Review of Books, how he blazed across the media sky, how visible he remains to the naked eye even now, 12 months later. Tabloidoids read all about it across the front page. Broadsheeters spilt their granola when Radio 4 reported who had fallen and how. That aviary of vultures and tits, the columnists, eulogized the lost king of arts in tribute after twittering tribute. I, by contrast, have maintained a dignified counsel until now. I should warn the busy reader, however, that the after-dinnerment of Felix Finch is merely the aperitif of my own peripatetic tribulations, the ghastly ordeal of Timothy Cavendish, if you will. Now that is a snappy title. It was the night of the Lemon Prize Awards, held in Jake's Starlight Bar, grandly reopened atop a Bayswater edifice with a rooftop garden thrown in for good measure. The whole ruddy publishing food chain had taken to the air and roosted at Jake's. The haunted writers, the celebrity chefs, the suits, the goateed buyers, the malnourished booksellers, packs of hacks and photographers who take drop dead to mean, why, I'd love to. Let me scotch that insidious little rumour implying Dermot's invitation was my doing, that, oh yes, Timothy Cavendish knew his author was lusting for a high-profile revenge, QED, the entire tragedy was a publicity stunt. Tosh, dreamt up by jealous rivals. No one ever owned up to sending Dermot Hoggins's invitation, and she is hardly likely to step forward now. Anyway, the winner was announced, and we all know who got the 50K prize money. I got sloshed. Guy the Guy introduced me to a cocktail called Ground Control to Major Tom. Time's Arrow became Time's Boomerang, and I lost count of all my majors. A jazz sextet kicked off a rumba. I went onto the balcony for a breather and surveyed the hubbub from without. Literary London at play put me in mind of Gibbon on the Age of the Antonines. A cloud of critics, of compilers, of commentators darkened the face of learning, and the decline of genius was soon followed by the corruption of taste. Dermot found me. Bad news inexorably does. Let me reiterate. Bumping into Pope Pius XIII would have surprised me less. In fact, his infallibility would have blended in better. My malcontent author wore a banana suit over a chocolate shirt and a Ribena tie. I hardly need remind the curious reader that Knuckles Sandwich was yet to take the book world by storm. It was yet to enter a bookshop, in fact, except the sage John Sandoz of Chelsea, and those hapless newsagents, once Jewish, then Sikh, now Eritrean, located in the Hoggins Brothers East End parish. Indeed, it was matters of publicity and distribution that Dermot wished to discuss on the roof garden. I explained to him for the 100th time how an author partnership set-up like Cavendish Publishing simply cannot fritter away money on fancy catalogues and team-building go-karting weekends for sales forces. I explained, yet again, that my authors derived fulfillment from presenting their handsomely bound volumes to friends, to family, to posterity. I explained, yet again, that the gangster chic market was saturated, and that even Moby Dick bombed in Melville's lifetime, though I did not deploy that particular verb. It is a truly fabulous memoir, I assured him. Give it time. Dermot, drunk, doleful, and deaf, looked over the railings. All them chimneys, long way down. The menace, I trusted, was imaginary. Quite. Mum took me to Mary Poppins when I was a nipper. Chimney sweeps dancing on rooftops. She watched it on video, too, over and over, in her nursing home. I remember when it came out. That dates me. Here, Dermot frowned and pointed into the bar through the French windows. Who's that? Who's who? Him in the bow tie, chatting up the tiara in the bin liner. The presenter fellow, Felix, oh, Felix, what is it? Felix fucking Finch. That cunt who shat on my book in his poncy fucking mag. It wasn't your best review, but it was my only fucking review. It really didn't read so badly. Yeah? None hit wonders like Mr. Hoggins are the roadkills of modern letters. Notice how people insert the Mr. before sinking the blade in? Mr. Hoggins should apologize to the trees felled for his bloated autobio novel. 400 vainglorious pages expire in an ending flat and inane quite beyond belief. Steady now, Dermot. Nobody actually reads the Trafalgar. Excuse, my author collared a waiter. Heard of the Trafalgar Review of Books? Why, sure, the East European waiter replied. My entire faculty swears by the TRB. They've got the smartest reviewers. Dermot flung his glass over the railing. Come now, what's a reviewer? I reasoned. One who reads quickly, arrogantly, but never wisely. The jazz sextet finished their number, and Dermot left my sentence dangling. I was drunk enough to justify a taxi and was about to leave when a Cockney town crier sound-alike silenced the entire gathering. "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, your attention, please." Saints preserve us. Dermot was clanging a couple of trays together. "We have an additional award tonight, fellow book fairies," he bellowed. Ignoring arch chuckles and oohs, he produced an envelope from his jacket pocket, slit it open, and pretended to read. "Award for most eminent literary critic." His audience looked on, cockatooed, booed, or turned away in embarrassment. Competition was fierce, but the panel was unanimous in choosing His Imperial Majesty of the Trafalgar Review of Books, Mr. Beg Pudding, Sir Felix Finch, OB&E, come on down. Stirrers crowed. "Bravo, Felix, bravo!" Finch wouldn't have been a critic if he didn't love unearned attention. Doubtless he was already composing copy in his head for his Sunday Times column, A Finch About Town. For his part, Dermot was all sincerity and smiles. "What might my prize be, I wonder?" Finch smirked as the applause subsided. "A signed copy of an unpulped Knuckles sandwich? Can't be many of those left." Finch's coterie chorused hooty laughter, spurring on their commissar. "Or do I win a free flight to a South American country with leaky extradition treaties?" "Yeah, lovey," Dermot winked. "A free flight is exactly what you won." My author grabbed Finch's lapels, rolled backwards, sank his feet into Finch's girth, and judo-propelled the shorter-than-generally-realized media personality high into the night air, high above the pansies lining the balcony railing. Finch's shriek, his life, ended in crumpled metal 12 floors down. Someone's drink poured onto the carpet. Dermot Duster Hoggins brushed his lapels, leaned over the balcony and yelled, "So who's expired in an ending flat and inane quite beyond belief now?" The dumbstruck crowd parted as the murderer made his way to the Nibbles table. Several witnesses later recalled a dark halo. He selected a Belgian cracker adorned with Biscay anchovies and parsley drizzled with sesame oil. The crowd's senses flooded back. Gagging noises, oh my gods, and a stampede for the stairs. The most frightful hullabaloo. My thoughts, honestly? Horror, assuredly. Shock, you bet. Disbelief? Naturally. Fear? Not really. I will not deny a nascent sense of a silver lining to this tragic turn. My Haymarket office suite housed 95 unsold shrink wraps of Dermot Hoggins's Knuckles sandwich, impassioned memoir of Britain's soon-to-be-most famous murderer, Frank Spratt, my stalwart printer in Sevenoaks, to whom I owed so much money I had the poor man over a barrel, still had the plates and was ready to roll at a moment's notice. Hard covers, ladies and gentlemen, £14.99 a shot. A taste of honey. As an experienced editor, I disapprove of flashbacks, foreshadowings, and tricksy devices. They belong in the 1980s with MAs in postmodernism and chaos theory. I make no apology, however, for restarting my own narrative with my version of that shocking affair. You see, it paved my first good intention on the road to Hull, or rather Hull's hinterland, where my ghastly ordeal is fated to unfold. My fortune took the glorious turn I had foreseen after Felix Finch's final fling. On the wings of sweet, free publicity, my knuckle sandwich turkey soared up the bestseller charts, where it roosted until poor Dermot was sentenced to 15 of the best in Wormwood Scrubs. The trial made the 9 o'clock news at every turn. In death, Sir Felix changed from a smug-scented pomposity with a Stalinist grip on Arts Council money into, oh, Britain's best-loved arts guru since the last one. On the steps of the Old Bailey, his widow told reporters 15 years was disgustingly lenient, and the very next day a Duster Hoggins Rot in Hell campaign was launched. Dermot's family counterattacked on chat shows. Finch's offending review was pored over. BBC Two commissioned a special documentary in which the lesbian who interviewed me edited my witticisms wholly out of context. Who cared? The money pot bubbled away. No, it boiled over and set the entire ruddy kitchen alight. Cavendish Publishing, Mrs. Latham and I, that is, didn't know what had hit us. We had to take on two of her nieces, part-time, of course. I wasn't getting clobbered for national insurance. The original knuckle sandwich shrink wraps vanished within 36 hours, and Frank Spratt was reprinting on a near-monthly basis. Nothing in my 4 decades in the publishing game had geared us for such success. Running costs had always been recouped from author donations, not from actual ruddy sales. It seemed almost unethical. Yet here I was, with a bestseller of one-in-a-decade proportions on my lists. People ask me, Tim, how do you account for its runaway success? Knuckle Sandwich was actually a well-written, gutsy, fictional memoir. Culture vultures discussed its socio-political subtexts first on late-night shows, then on breakfast TV. Neo-Nazis bought it for its generous lashings of violence. Worcestershire housewives bought it because it was a damn fine read. Homosexuals bought it out of tribal loyalty. It shifted 90,000, yes, 90,000 copies in 4 months. And yes, I am still talking hardcover. The feature film should be in production as I write. At the Frankfurt Book Love-In, I was feted by people who until then had never so much as paused to scrape me off their shoes. That odious label, Vanity Publisher, became Creative Financier. Translation rights fell like territories in the final round of Risk. The American publishers, glory, glory, hallelujah, they loved the limey aristo gets comeuppance from downtrodden Gaelic sun hook, and a transatlantic auction skyrocketed the advance to giddy heights. I, yes, I, had exclusive rights to this platinum goose with a bad case of the trots. Money entered my cavernously empty accounts like the North Sea through a Dutch dike. My personal banking consultant, a spiv named Elliot McCluskey, sent me a Christmas card photo of his midwitch cuckoo offspring. The primates on the Groucho Club door greeted me with a "Pleasant evening, Mr. Cavendish," instead of an "Oi, you gotta be signed in by a member." When I announced that I would be handling the paperback release myself, the Sunday's book pages ran pieces depicting Cavendish Publishing as a dynamic white-hot player in a cloud of decrepit gas giants. I even made the FT. Was it any wonder Mrs. Latham and I were overstretched, just a smidge, on the bookkeeping front? Success intoxicates rookies in the blink of an eye. I got business cards printed up. Cavendish Redux, publishers of cutting-edge fiction. Well, I thought, why not sell publications instead of publication? Why not become the serious publisher that the world lauded me as? Alack-a-day, those dinky little cards were the red flag waved at the bull of fate. At the first rumor that Tim Cavendish was flush, my saber-toothed meerkat creditors bounded into my office. As ever, I left the Gnostic algebra of what to pay whom and when to my priceless Mrs. Latham. So it was I was mentally and financially underprepared when my midnight callers visited nearly a year after the Felix Finch night. I confess that since Madam X left me, my cuckold was a dentist. I shall reveal the truth, no matter how painful. Housekeeping anarchy had reigned o'er my Putney domicile. Oh, very well, the bastard was a German. So my porcelain throne has long been my de facto office seat. A decent cognac sits under the ball-gowned lavatory roll cover, and I leave the door open so I can hear the kitchen radio. The night in question, I had put aside my perpetual lavatory read, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, because of all the manuscripts, inedible green tomatoes, submitted to Cavendish Redux, my new stable of champions. I suppose it was about 11 o'clock when I heard my front door being interfered with. Skinhead munchkins, mug-or-treating, cherry knockers, the wind. Next thing I knew, the door flew in off its ruddy hinges. I was thinking Al-Qaeda. I was thinking ball lightning. But no. Down the hallway tramped what seemed like an entire rugby team, though my intruders numbered only three. You'll notice I'm always attacked in threes. "Timothy," pronounced the gargoyliest. "Cavendish, I presume. Caught with your cacks down." "My business hours are 11 to 2, gentlemen," Bogart would have said, "with a 3-hour break for lunch. Kindly leave." All I could do was blurt, "Oi, my door, my ruddy door." Thug, too, lit a cigarette. "We visited Dermot today. He's a bit frustrated. Who wouldn't be?" The pieces fell into place. I fell into pieces. Dermot's brothers! I'd read all about them in Dermot's book, Eddie Mazza Jarvis. Hot ash burnt my thigh, and I lost track of which face uttered what. It was a Francis Bacon triptych come to life. "Knuckle sandwich is doing nicely, by the looks of things. Piles of it in the airport bookshops. You must at least have suspected we'd come calling. A man of your business acumen." The London Irish unnerved me at the best of times. "Boys, boys, Dermot signed a copyright transfer contract. Look, look, it's industry standard. I have a copy in my briefcase here." I did indeed have the document to hand. "Clause 18 about copyright means Knuckle Sandwich legally is, It wasn't easy to tell them this with my briefs around my ankles. Legally the property of Cavendish Publishing. Jarvis Hoggins scanned the contract for a moment, but tore it up when it proved longer than his concentration span. "Dermot signed this fucking pants when his book was just a fucking hobby. A present to our sick old man, God rest her soul. A souvenir of Dad's heyday. Dermot never signed no fucking contract for the event of the fucking season. We paid your printer, Mr. Spratt, a little visit. He went through the economics for us." Contract confetti showered. Mazza was close enough for me to smell his dinner. "Quite a hill of Hoggins Brothers' cash you've raked in, it seems. I'm sure we can agree on a, funds flowchart, which will..." Eddie cut in.
"Let's make it 3.
I feigned a wince. £3,000? Boys, I don't think... "Don't be a silly Billy." Mazza pinched my cheek. 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. Your office." I had no choice. Perhaps we might, moot a provisional sum to conclude this meeting as a basis for ongoing negotiation.
"Okie dokie. What sum did we moot earlier, Mazza?"
"50K sounded reasonable." My cry of pain was unfeigned. £50,000? For starters. My intestines bubbled, toiled and troubled. "Do you really think I keep that kind of money lying around in shoeboxes?" I pitched my voice for Dirty Harry, but it was more lisping Baggins. "I hope you keep it lying around somewhere, Grandpops."
"Cash. No bollocks, no checks."
"No promises, no deferments.
Old-fashioned money, a shoebox will do fine."
"Gentlemen, I'm happy to pay a negotiated consideration, but the law..." Jarvis whistled through his teeth. "Will the law help a man of your years bounce back from multiple spinal fractures, Timothy?"
Eddie. "Men of your age don't bounce. They splat." I fought with all my might, but my sphincter was no longer my own, and a cannonade fired off. Amusement or condescension I could have borne, but my tormentor's pity signified my abject defeat. The toilet chain was pulled. 3 o'clock. Cavendish Redux went down the pan. Out trooped the thugs over my prostrate door. Eddie turned for a last word. Dermot did a nice little paragraph in his book. On loan defaulters. I refer the curious reader to page 244 of Knuckle Sandwich, available from your local bookshop. Not on a full stomach. Outside my Haymarket office suite, taxis inched and sprinted. Inside my inner sanctum, Mrs. Latham's Nefertiti earrings, a gift from me to mark her 10th year with Cavendish Publishing, I found them in a British Museum gift shop bargain bin, jingled as she shook her head, no, no, no. And I'm telling you, Mr. Cavendish, that I cannot find you £50,000 by 3 o'clock this afternoon. I cannot find you £5,000. Every knuckle sandwich penny has already been hoovered up by long-standing debts. Doesn't anybody owe us money? I always keep on top of the invoicing, Mr. Cavendish, do I not? Desperation makes me wheedle. This is the age of ready credit. This is the age of credit limits, Mr. Cavendish. I retired to my office, poured myself a whiskey, and sloshed down my Dickie Ticker pills before tracing Captain Cook's last voyage on my antique globe. Mrs. Latham brought in the mail and left without a word. Bills, junk, moral muggings from charity fundraisers, and a package addressed F.A.O., the visionary editor of Knuckle Sandwich, containing a manuscript titled Half Lives, lousy name for a work of fiction, and subtitled The First Louisa Ray Mystery. Lousier and lousier. Its lady author, one dubiously named Hilary V. Hush, began her covering letter with the following. When I was 9, my mum took me to Lourdes to pray for my bedwetting to be cured. Imagine my surprise when not St. Bernadette, but Alain Fournier appeared in a vision that night. Nutcase, ahoy! I threw the letter away into my urgent business tray and switched on my spanking new fat gigabyte computer for a game of Minesweeper. After getting blown up twice, I telephoned Sotheby's to offer Charles Dickens's own original, authentic writing desk for auction with a reserve price of $60,000. A charming evaluator named Kirpal Singh commiserated that the novelist's desk was already accounted for by the Dickens House Museum and hoped I had not been fleeced too painfully. I confess, I do lose track of my little elaborations. Next, I called Elliot McCluskey and asked after his delightful kiddies. Fine, thank you. He asked after my delightful business. I asked for a loan of £80,000. He began with a thoughtful, right. I lowered my ceiling to 60. Elliot pointed out that my performance-linked credit stream still had a 12-month flow horizon before resizing could be feasibly optioned. Oh, I miss the days when they'd laugh like a hyena, tell you to go to hell, and hang up. I traced Magellan's voyage across my globe and longed for a century when a fresh beginning was no further than the next clipper out of Deptford. My pride already in tatters, I gave Madame X a bell. She was having her A.M. soak. I explained the gravity of my situation. She laughed like a hyena, told me to go to hell, and hung up. I spun my globe. I spun my globe. Mrs. Latham eyeballed me like a hawk watching a bunny as I stepped outside. No, not a lone shark, Mr. Cavendish. It just isn't worth it. Never fear, Mrs. Latham. I'm just going to pay a call on the one man in the world who believes in me, fair weather or foul. In the lift, I reminded my reflection, blood is thicker than water, before spiking my palm on the spoke of my telescopic umbrella. Oh, Satan's gonads, not you. Look, just get lost and leave us in peace.
My brother glared across his swimming pool as I stepped down his patio. Denham's never swum in his pool, as far as I know, but he does all the chlorinating and whatnot every week, just the same, even in blustery drizzle.